I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today I'm talking to Charles Griswold, Borden Parker Bone Professor of Philosophy at Boston University. We're discussing his 2018 book, Jean-Jacques Rousseau and Adam Smith, A Philosophical Encounter, from Routledge. Griswold works on ancient and modern philosophy and moral and political philosophy. His books include Forgiveness, A Philosophical Exploration, Adam Smith and the Virtues of Enlightenment, and Self-Knowledge and Plato's Phaedrus, as well as many edited books and articles. So, first of all, let me say thank you so much, Charles Griswold, for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm very much looking forward to our conversation.
So, Charles, I really love the book. It was an excellent book. It was a really great analysis of both Rousseau and Smith and putting them into dialogue and in quite a sophisticated and interesting way. And I love both thinkers. And I love when those thinkers are both put into dialogue because they have a lot to say to one another. So I appreciated the book. I always start by asking authors how they came to the book. So why did you write a book about Rousseau and Smith?
Well, it goes without saying that each of these thinkers is extremely interesting. They are, each of them, hugely influential. And of course, have been the subject of an enormous amount of commentary. And I think that putting them together, pairing them, and constructing a kind of a dialogue between them is also yields very interesting results. Of course, the proof is in the pudding, and people will have to judge that for themselves. But the claim that I'm making is that thinking about them in contrast to each other and comparing their ideas helps us to understand the ideas and also to evaluate them. Of course, Rousseau and Smith were roughly contemporaneous. To some extent, they moved in similar circles, though they apparently never met. They're addressing some of the same issues, and yet, interestingly, they both agree and disagree about these issues, issues which I would maintain are very important philosophically. So it's a very fruitful for reasons such as those, the dialectic between them, I think, is unusually interesting and fruitful to explore.
Yeah. Can you say a little bit, just at the outset, about a little bit maybe more about what their personal relationship was? So they never met, but Smith did have a short-ish review of Rousseau's Second Discourse. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. They, as far as we know, they never met. It seems, as far as we know, that Rousseau never read any Smith. But Smith did own Rousseau's works, and he published a review in 1756 of the now very famous Second Discourse, as it's called. I should add that I'm not really interested in the question of influence per se, although I actually would claim that in various ways Rousseau influenced Smith, but more in constructing this kind of dialectic between the two thinkers.
Right. Yeah. I found that helpful to sort of imagine a dialogue between the two of them that we wish they had, but they unfortunately didn't. I gather from your book that Smith's review of Rousseau was rather dismissive. I mean, it sort of reconstructs Rousseau's Second Discourse as something like an ungrounded speculative history.
Yeah, it's a it's a complicated and interesting review. He is very clearly calling people's attention to Rousseau and implicitly saying, this is worth reading, take a look at this. And he translates and quotes three pretty substantial sections or paragraphs, really, or parts of paragraphs of the Second Discourse. And they're very well chosen and convey a lot of the, the spirit and the essence of Rousseau's argument, if that's the right word, or narrative in the Second Discourse. Smith also offers some very interesting comparisons between Rousseau and Mandeville, and these have been, all of this has been heavily discussed in the secondary literature. But at the same time, there's a sort of a dismissive statement by Smith to the effect that you know, there's no point commenting on a lot of the text because it's mostly rhetoric and description. So
right.
It's an interesting mix of the two, but I was certainly joined with those who say that by translating and quoting these texts, Smith is highlighting their importance and, you know, the fact that it's worthwhile studying them.
Yeah, so let's talk about the particular themes, theme that you take up and the sort of sub-themes under that theme that you construct the dialogue around. The theme that sort of structures the book is the idea or the problem of the self. So what drove you to talk about, discuss this topic in particular?
So, you know, a number of people have written about Smith and Rousseau. I think, for example, of this splendid work by Dennis Rasmussen and Ryan Hanley, Michael Ignatieff, Michael Rosen, and others. And so a lot of interesting issues have been well explored by others, in particular the issue of commercial society, or what we now call capitalism, and the diverging assessments of that society by Rousseau and Smith. But it struck me that there was maybe more to say with regard to what I loosely call the question of the self, which is a question that is composed of a number of distinct but closely related issues, which I think of as sort of like interlaced strands of a complex web. And these would include questions such as what we are by nature, and so whether sociability is natural or acquired. Questions about who we become, what kind of people we become, questions as to whether we can know ourselves and know each other, and then questions about how best to articulate our condition. Of course, questions about the nature of freedom, and also about what, if anything, can be done to remedy our condition. So in the course of the sort of cluster of issues, problems of illusion, self-deception and deception, and what I call self-falsification also arise. So what I tried to do in the book is to address various aspects of this, you know, question of the self in each of the five chapters in a way that permits readers who are particularly interested in one theme or another to just read that chapter, but which also, you know, connects the chapters to each other, and I hope builds an overall sort of case or comparison between the two. I guess I should add that the way the book is structured, with one exception, which is chapter 3, what I did was to sort of imitate the pattern of, you know, Smith's review of Rousseau by starting off with Rousseau, thinking about what Smith's take would be on the same issues, and then sort of constructing a back and forth between the two of them. Always, if I may add, this also within a restricted range of texts, because it's, you know, impossible to construct a dialogue like this, taking into account everything Rousseau wrote and everything that Smith wrote. So, you know, Rousseau's Emile, for example, which could be also a fruitful part of such a dialogue, receives very little attention here. I guess the underlying impulse here, Jeff, is that, you know, philosophy is fundamentally dialogical. It's a fundamentally dialectical enterprise, and that by thinking through issues here with the help of Rousseau and Smith, we're better able to get to the truth of the matter and better able to assess the strengths and weaknesses of the relevant positions.
It's long struck me that Rousseau and Smith are distinctive in the sort of development of the modern view of the self, mm-hmm. in that you say in the just sort of philosophical tradition, going back to Descartes, there's a conception of the self that's sort of transparent to itself. One can access the cogito easily, or in the political theory side of things, there's a tradition that goes through Hobbes and Locke of the sort of solitary individual in the state of nature, which of course Rousseau picks up, but then complicates as soon as human beings get into society. So with Rousseau and Smith, you start to get a much more of a, well, a self that's not opaque to itself, that requires others for its own self-understanding, that has sort of levels of self-deception. You get sort of a much more, you say, modern conception of the self that really requires a kind of dialogic analysis, right? That the selves themselves are constituted through a kind of dialogue, which is sort of then is reflected in the structure of your own book, that it's dialogic. Does that seem right to you?
Yes, it does. And in fact, the issue of our transparency, to use Rousseau's term, which is made famous by Starobinsky's, you know, much read commentary on Rousseau, the issue of the transparency of the self or the lack thereof is indeed critical to the debate, as I am reconstructing it, between Rousseau and Smith. And it actually comes up very early in Rousseau in this play of his called Narcisse or Narcissus. And in the first chapter of the book, I talk about the play and also the preface to it that Rousseau attached to it many years after he composed it. Because the play, I think, helps to bring out part of, you know, how this lack of transparency works and what the problem with transparency or accessibility is to the self and to the selves of others. And in conjunction with the preface, I think helps to shed some light on what Rousseau thinks, as it were, the heart of the social problem is, the problem of society or civilization is.
Yeah, so let's turn to that first chapter and your first theme on narcissism and theatricality. Sort of Rousseau's critique of civilization and the ills of civilization brought on by our amour propre are fairly well known, and perhaps even the preface to Narcissus is somewhat well known to many political theorists and philosophers. Maybe you could say a little bit about the play itself, which you go into in an interesting way, mm-hmm. and you contrast it with the Narcissus story, Ovid's story. What is the play and the preface to the play sort of add to our understanding of Rousseau?
So, as always in Rousseau, the situation is interpretatively or hermeneutically complicated. He seems to be a master of this. So he attached this preface to this play. The preface is, as I think you just indicated, a defense of the argument of the first discourse. So you've got the question of the relation between the preface and the first discourse. And I think, broadly speaking, the preface continues the argument of the first discourse and defends that critique of modern society, maybe just society as such. But it is also a defense by Rousseau of himself against the charge that he's inconsistent, because he, after all, did criticize the arts and the letters in the first discourse and does in the preface. And yet he himself composed plays and other, you know, forms of literary, you know, works. So it would seem that he's inconsistent. And so he's wanting to defend himself against the charge that he's inconsistent or incoherent. While also sort of testing himself with regard to his self-knowledge to see whether he too is, you know, pursuing esteem in order to become, you know, esteemed and famous and so forth, or whether there's, you know, whether he is self-knowing and honest. So you've got those issues at play in the preface. The play to which it is the preface is a appropriation in part of Ovid, Ovid's Narcissus, the famous story in Ovid. So you've got another complicated question of relation between Rousseau's play, Rousseau's version of Narcissus, and Ovid's version. So to cut to the heart of the matter, in the play, the main character, whose name is Valère, falls in love with a portrait of himself in which he is, in effect, cross-dressed, but doesn't recognize himself in the portrait. So he is, as one of the other characters puts it, metaphorized in this portrait. And so the question arises, you know, is this a case of vanity? Not exactly, because it's not really a mirror that he's looking into. It's more an illustration of something which Paul de Man calls, of loving oneself as though one were the other, a case in which one's self-image and image of the other are hopelessly intertwined. And I think that, so this is like Ovid's Narcissus, who looks in the, in the stream, sees his image and falls in love with it, not knowing that it's him. So the question that this puts, I think, is first, does this capture the essence of our relations to others? In loving others or in knowing others, are we really in love with or knowing our own, a projection of our own selves, but unknowingly so? That's one question which arises. And another question is, can human life withstand the test of self-knowledge? Because if we come to understand, and this is clear in Ovid's version of the story, that what we're in love with is our own image, that would seem to debunk and undermine our love of the other. So this question as to whether self-knowledge is even desirable arises. So to connect this back to the preface, one of the sort of worries that then arises is that social relations in general are like this. They are based on self-effacing projections, on a kind of theatricality without self-conscious acting. And that's a kind of a nightmarish possibility, nightmarish vision of society. And it's the situation is made even worse again if it's the case that self-knowledge would debunk our illusions about our accessibility to others, or the others, the accessibility of others to us, debunk our illusions in a way that would undermine the possibility of, you know, commerce between people. So I think at this stage, when writing the preface, Rousseau is in a sort of aporia about whether or not the self-knowledge is in fact a good thing to have. He's ambivalent about this, I think, at this stage.
But yet he produces a play, and presumably, I mean, is it put on? I actually don't know this. But yeah, I mean, presumably this is something public that then, you know, part of the aim is to get the audience to confront this in themselves.
That's right. But on the other hand, given that, given the possible results, I mean, if people were really enlightened, where would this leave them? What is the constructive alternative to this? I mean, is this a tragic dilemma that we're in? I think these are some of the questions that arise from precisely Rousseau's actions and as well as his words.
Right. They have to go to Sparta, I guess. Or they have to join up into a republic. Go ahead.
No, right. But of course, we can't join up in a republic because Spartan republics are finished.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So let's shift over to Smith, who has quite a different view than Rousseau on this, though he does also have, as we've been talking about, a more socialized conception of the self. Mm-hmm. How does he differ from Rousseau on this?
So first off, he doesn't face this sort of consistency problem because he doesn't criticize the arts and the letters in a way that Rousseau does. So, you know, Rousseau criticizes them and then writes a play and so forth. People say, well, you're incoherent. You're doing what you said one shouldn't do. So Smith doesn't face that problem, although he's certainly very interested in the arts and so forth and very knowledgeable about the arts and the letters. He's also well aware of the difficulty of self-knowledge. He understands the phenomena of vanity, the pursuit of esteem, you know, of literary disputes, which is also comes up in Rousseau. He's perfectly well attuned to all of that. But Smith, I think, believes that we have resources at our disposal which can help to some extent to protect us against some of the vices and problems that Rousseau is pointing to, one of which is a desire to be not only praised, but to also be praiseworthy. Another is that he's not as critical of philosophy as Rousseau is. I think he views philosophy as a bit more like mathematics, in that it is, to some extent anyways, insulated from the pressures of public esteem, so there's a little space there for kind of objective philosophical analysis. Another, I think, point of difference between them is that Smith has this notion of the impartial spectator, which I'm sure we'll be coming back to. And I think that Rousseau is very skeptical of the spectatorial standpoint and wants to, offers something more like introspection, or I guess as we'll also talk about, illumination as an alternative to the spectatorial standpoint. So although Smith certainly understands the role of illusion in life, he certainly understands the notion of projection, of what I am calling Ovidian narcissism, this kind of unself-aware projection, he doesn't end up seeing common life or social life as theatrical in the way that Rousseau does. It's kind of fake and inauthentic, but in this particularly nightmarish way, such that people are play-acting without knowing that they're play-acting.
Right. And is that a kind of corruption of our natural relationship to one another? I'm trying to think on Smith how actually, what's the account of how actually that theatricality or vanity emerges?
It can be a role. Let me start over there. It can lead to corruption. And Smith is explicitly aware of what he calls the corruption of the moral sentiments that can arise from pursuing wealth and so forth. So there's, other commentators have argued, he in effect concedes quite a bit to Rousseau's point. But there are also these defenses against it, and a thesis to the effect that it's possible to combine activities such as pursuing wealth, even when that pursuit is governed by a kind of or motivated by a kind of illusion. It's possible to combine that with virtue, with justice. So this maybe is something we'll also be coming back to in our conversation. But I suppose from Rousseau's standpoint, Smith is trying to have his cake and eat it too.
Yeah, good. I mean, just as an aside, before we move on to the next theme, I in reading your book, which I really liked the sort of back and forth. There's really a dialectical character to the book. It's back and forth. I wasn't sure at the end of the day whether you came down on one side or the other. I hate to put you on the spot here, but did you conceive of yourself as sort of coming down on one side or the other in each of these themes, or was your role more of a kind of umpire here?
I did not take a position in the book. My position, that is to say, I didn't take a position sort of pro Rousseau or pro Smith at the end of the day, or pronounce one right and the other wrong. The position I took was that it's useful to try to flesh out the dialectic between them. And I suppose the book is in that sense open-ended, or not exactly operatic, but it doesn't decide the matter. It seeks to dig as deeply as I can into some of these issues. Again, obviously building on, my scholarly predecessors, but to dig as deep as I can into the interpretive and evaluative issues, and then sort of place it before the reader and then let the reader take it from there.
Found that very, very useful, very illuminating. So let's turn to the second theme, the second chapter, where you discuss the genealogy or genealogical approaches of both thinkers. And again, you start with Rousseau, as you say, talk mainly about his second discourse, which the second discourse is a genealogy of sorts. That is, it gives an account of the coming to be or genesis of civilization from our basic natures. But Rousseau, as you say, has this problem of any genealogist, which is Rousseau criticizes Hobbes and others insofar as they try to import their own sort of visions of the natural condition. And they're really, in Rousseau's view, only bringing their sort of notion of Englishness back into nature. But Rousseau has this problem. How does he overcome that same problem? Why isn't he just importing his own Geneva-ness back into the state of nature? So you could say a little bit about Rousseau's genealogy and how he attempts to overcome this problem.
Right. So we're certainly familiar these days with the idea of a genealogical method, thanks in part to Nietzsche. There are a number of contemporary philosophers writing about this. Bernard Williams, of course, did, but others are doing that also. And as a number of people have pointed out, one of the possible strengths of a genealogical method is that it can, to borrow this term from Frederick Neuhauser, denaturalize what custom has made to seem to be the way it is. Denaturalize by making what seems to be the way it is contingent, to show that it could have been otherwise or it could be otherwise. And so this is a way of trying to show that it's not just natural that things are the way they are. For example, you know, the way inequality of wealth is. It doesn't have to be that way. So genealogical method can be a very powerful way of undermining certain kinds of assumptions about the world. What I propose is that the bulk of the second discourse, not the whole thing by any means, but the bulk of it, be understood as a genealogical narrative, to use this phrase that I borrow from McIntyre, that is motivated by a deep assumption of Rousseau's, which is that we are in the condition of happy slaves, as he calls it in the first discourse. That is to say that we are not only lacking in self-knowledge, but that we are unaware of our own ignorance. So this is back to the sort of theatricality without acting view that we talked about a moment ago. The situation is made even more acute on Rousseau's telling because philosophy too is infected by the corruption, which this process described by the genealogical narrative has wrought, so that when someone like Hobbes tries to understand it, what he's really doing is projecting unknowingly the current reality onto nature. So philosophical reasoning too is making the problem worse, actually. Reasoning is self-vitiating in this way. And of course, then this leads to the problem that you mentioned, which is, if all of that is true, how would anybody ever come to know that it is true? What is the genealogy of the genealogist, to again paraphrase something that McIntyre says in a book of his? And I suggest that Rousseau offers an answer in his descriptions of what's referred to as the illumination on the road to Vincennes, which supposedly took place in 1749. And this illumination is essentially a kind of conversion experience, as Rousseau describes it, which he, says he had when he read this, prize essay challenge issued by the Academy of Dijon. It suddenly sort of struck him a whole new way of envisioning the social world. Suddenly hit home, and he sort of sat down and he wept and he saw the critical contradictions of the social system. And that led to his writing the first discourse, which won the prize, and then the second discourse and Emile, and undoubtedly influenced his other work too. So he solves, if that's the right word, the genealogy of the genealogist problem with this story about this illumination that he had on the road to, this Vincennes, which is outside of Paris. So one big question, of course, is, is that persuasive philosophically. But another is, you know, is the result of it, which is, again, the genealogical narrative in good part of the second discourse, which is, I think, designed to shock the reader out of their ignorance of ignorance. How comforting is that result? How good for us is it? Because the narrative of the second discourse is really painful. He is very clear that the result of this whole human project is going to be basically a war of all against all. And he presents it as inevitable. So it could seem like a enlightening and awakening story, but also immobilizing story. So we're back to the question there of the desirability of self-knowledge as well as the possibility of it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, so I've often thought of the argument, as it were, that the second discourse is something like a subtraction story. That is, that if you want to get back to nature, you can take human beings as we are now, and you can take away politics, like mm-hmm. Hobbes or Locke do. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't get back far enough. You need to subtract more things. So you need to take away, you know, our sense of honor, our social relationships, our reason, and so forth. And so you're left with what's, I guess, most elemental that you can't subtract away. I suppose the problem with that is then, you know, it's still what licenses Rousseau to stick with what he has at the end of the day, you know, this amour de soi, this sense of self-preservation, pity, freedom, perfectibility, those elements that he takes as sort of elemental. So I suppose there still would be that problem with that kind of approach, but I'm not sure what you think about that sort of subtraction approach there.
Yeah, that seems right. Subtraction, I guess people have suggested, you know, abstraction, some kind of approach where you sort of strip away everything but the sort of what you would think of as the bare essentials, you know, the desire for self-preservation, PTA, according to Rousseau. You know, there's some kind of potentiality for change. He calls it strangely perfectibility. Maybe free will is a fourth element there. So, get us back to the true state of nature and then build from there. But as you say, there's so many questions about this. I mean, why are those, how does Rousseau know that those are the right axioms, so to speak, to start from? How would anybody know how things developed? Because this is sort of a prehistory history.
Hmm.
So these are kind of famous interpretive problems that many people have commented upon. But I think maybe one useful way to look at it is that he's telling this narrative in view of this fundamental assumption that we are ignorant of our ignorance and the extreme contrast between, you know, the savage, which he uses as a term of praise, and us is drawn repeatedly, including at the very end of the work. So it's a kind of mirror, if you like. It has this kind of pedagogic function in that sense.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and of course the statement about the natural goodness of man has its own sort of philosophical values. Somebody, Josh Cohen, has developed that at length, which is very, very useful. So to switch over to Smith has quite a different view of history than Rousseau. He doesn't have this the fall story, the fall from this kind of Edenic natural state. Mm-hmm. So how do you characterize his genealogy or philosophy of history, if you want to use that term, in contrast?
Yeah, so he doesn't adopt the standpoint that Rousseau pretty explicitly adopts of the, you know, supreme outsider, the person who somehow stepped outside of the entire process and is able to characterize it or tell the story as a whole. He's not the, you know, the one great awakener, the great debunker. He doesn't position himself in that way, although there are ways in which he awakens and debunks. And to some extent, he's on the outside since he adopts a critical, you know, perspective on human life. But so it's not this kind of, in a way, radicalized removal of self as critic from the phenomena, first off. He certainly doesn't have a notion of original sin or a fall, as you said. I don't think he has a notion of human beings as naturally good. It's more like, for Smith, we're composite creatures by nature with capacities for good and bad, and that a huge amount depends on the historical circumstances as to how precisely that works out. His historical, account is much more historical than what we typically see in Rousseau. Although there are bits of actual history in Rousseau, Smith, is an empiricist, and he's takes history very seriously, much more seriously, I think, than Rousseau does. So you've got an emphasis on empirical history there. But furthermore, you don't have this notion that we are happy slaves that we become happy slaves. You don't have this contrast between sort of happy, tranquil, savage on the one hand, who is pre-social, and on the other hand, our miserable lot of being happy slaves, which lot can be illuminated only by somebody who somehow managed to free themselves from this terrible situation through an illumination or conversion-like experience, which, Smith never refers to himself as having had and never demands of his reader.
Right. Smith does, as you say, though, have a conception of human nature. And, when he discusses the sort of the natural, he at least makes an argument about commercial society, at least in part, that it's a more of a natural relationship between human beings than otherwise. So I assume that the Rousseauan response would be something like, well, can't we just run the genealogical critique on Smith? What license is Smith to give offer his account of human nature, as it were?
Right. And part of the Smithian reply, I take it, is, let's develop a theory and let's look at numerous concrete examples of the, of the evidence drawn not only from our own culture, but from other cultures. And let's see if this theory, say a theory of sympathy or something like that, can shed light on or explain the phenomena. Does it withstand objections from competing theories? Can it account for how actors view themselves in their situations? Can it account for illusion and deception as well as self-knowledge and truth? So that, I think, the sort of the spirit of his reply is something like that.
Yeah, kind of deductive versus inductive approaches to human nature. Is that a way to characterize it?
Yeah, I'm not sure I would put it quite that way, but the spirit of it is, I think, probably right, that Smith is certainly wanting to work from, inductively, as you say, sort of empirically, and grounding the theory empirically and historically. Yeah. But yeah. You can see how, from Rousseau's standpoint, this is shaping up as another great dodge. I mean, we have the Hobbes problem.
Right. Yeah. Right. You say another way you put the distinction, this part of the book, is that Rousseau is like Plato in spirit and Smith is like Aristotle in spirit, which I loved that connection. Maybe you could expand on that.
Yeah, maybe that is another way to get at it. I'm hardly the first to note this, but Rousseau is Platonic in this way, that his picture of human life reminds one of the simile of the cave in Book 7 of the Republic, right? This the sort of the essential point being that we're like prisoners in this cave who don't know that they're prisoners, the sort of the nightmare vision again of the sort of theatricality without acting, or following the social script while actually being unaware the whole time that it is just a script. And so the idea is that freedom from that requires leaving the cave, a kind of a conversion experience, really. You remember Plato's word is turning of the soul, a peritrope of the soul. So how much as it were, can you, as the ordinary agent, trust your intuitions and your perceptions and your beliefs under those conditions? Well, not much, because of this kind of pervasive ignorance of ignorance. I think Smith rejects that. He's much more Aristotelian in that he thinks that there are common opinions, there are beliefs in common life that are more or less trustworthy, including starting with opinions or beliefs about ourselves. Maybe another way to put it is that, you know, for Smith, his confidence in common life, which is qualified to be sure, is underwritten by this idea that we can't be entirely ignorant of ourselves. That can't be the case. Why that's not the case, wish Smith had spelled out a bit more. But the idea presumably is something like this, that our self-conceptions must capture something of who we are, since after all, it's ourselves that they are expressing. This is intimately known territory. This is us. We can't get it completely wrong on this Smithian view. Of course, and this is the dialectic that I pursue. This kind of answer gives Rousseau an opening because he can call upon the fact that we do get it wrong a lot. So how would you know whether you're getting it right or wrong? How would you know whether your morals are right or wrong, or your self-conception is just a social role that you've gotten very, very used to and think is natural or not? I mean, after all, Smith himself talks about, for example, how false notions of religion, to use this phrase, corrupt the sentiments. So, in reply to this kind of, well, we know, in some broadly Aristotelian way, we know ourselves more or less, Rousseau can say, well, not really. I mean, you yourself have shown us that our sentiments are actually quite unreliable. Mm-hmm. I mean, again, in reply to that, I think Smith has these other resources, which include, some philosophical resources, such as, careful analysis, paying attention to the evidence, asking whether the theory explains the evidence, including evidence from different historical periods and cultures, a resistance to oversimplification in producing a theory is something that comes up very clearly at the end of the theory of moral sentiments, seeking out relevant debates, all things considered judgments, and also making sure not to confuse the standpoint of the theorist with that of the actor. So it's not like the Rousseauan reply is the end of the debate, because there's a Smithian reply to it.
Mm-hmm. But I take it the impartial spectator would play a role, right, in the sort of an attempt at achievement of an objective standpoint, right? I mean, so Smith doesn't claim that we can achieve an objective standpoint, but we can achieve the standpoint of sort of impartial subjectivity, as it were.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I mean, I don't know how. How convincing that would be from a Rousseau perspective, but it does strike me, and this still jumps a little bit ahead in a couple of your chapters in your book. But you talk about Smith and the impartial spectator as a sort of way in which Smith can overcome or address some of these problems that Rousseau addresses, and it strikes me that there's a kind of analog in Rousseau's thought with the idea of the general will, which is the general will is at least an attempt at achieving a kind of impartial point of view among many particular wills and factions in society. And at least that's it seems like that's the aim in both thinkers, is to educate the will to this impartial point of view, which helps overcome some of these conditions of dependence that both of them worry about. I don't know what you think about that kind of connection, whether you find the idea of the general will, the sort of analog of the impartial spectator, or whether that there are differences there.
Right. That's another great question. I think that I suppose there is an analogy there to be drawn, but there are also disanalogies. Of course, the notion of the general will is itself much contested as to what exactly it means. But bracketing all that for now, the general will comes up preeminently in the social contract. The impartial spectator comes up in the theory of moral sentiments. And I think that's not irrelevant because the impartial spectator, as I understand it, is not a perspective from which one legislates, let alone legislates something like the social contract. Presumably, if the general will does anything, it legislates the social contract, the true social contract, the one that Rousseau describes in the book of the same name. So the impartial spectator seems to be a way in which the individual can, which individuals can regulate, morally regulate, assess and regulate their own conduct and their own character and intentions, and assess the appropriateness or lack thereof of the conduct and intentions of other people, but is not, at least as I understand it, is not a standpoint from which one assesses systems of jurisprudence as a whole or systems of social cooperation as a whole. It's not the impartial spectator is not a philosopher in that way, and is not legislating. It doesn't have the common good as such in view. Whereas the general will, although it is also an impartialist standpoint, as I understand it, is focused on the general good, on the social contract. It is a form of self-legislation. It embodies what Rousseau calls moral freedom, this notion that one gives the law to oneself, a law that applies to everyone. So I think that the notions are importantly different in that way, although I do take your point about there being an analogy between them too.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just thinking through this now. I mean, it's interesting that Smith places the impartiality at the level of ethics or morality, whereas Rousseau has this point about impartiality at the level of politics. And I can see the disanalogy there. But what does Smith? I don't know about Smith as well, but does Smith? How hard is it for individuals to achieve the perspective of the impartial spectator? Because for Rousseau, it seems very, very difficult. Rousseau says the natural condition is to put a particular will first, or the corporate will second, and then the general will last. We have to really reverse that order in part through institutions like the civil religion, which you talk about in the later chapter. Does Smith think that presumably it's not easy to achieve the perspective of the impartial spectator? Does it need to be taught, or are we sort of naturally inclined in that direction?
So I think that he believes that the standpoint of the impartial spectator is available to all but the most corrupt human beings, but in degrees, and that it requires very substantial effort to really regulate one's life consistently and well in accordance with the standpoint of the impartial spectator. So I suppose it's gradualist might not be the right word, but a view of moral effort on a kind of spectrum for Smith. So we're able to adopt spectatorial standpoints on each other. We come to understand pretty early on what something like an impartial spectator position would be on ourselves and others. We do try to adopt that view, but to do it in this consistent way is very difficult, especially because of the dangers of self-love and of self-deception.
Yeah, so let's shift over to your third theme. You discuss pity and sympathy in Rousseau and Smith, respectively, which is a great connection because pity is central to Rousseau, certainly at least in the natural condition, and sympathy is actually absolutely pivotal for Smith. But you argue they're quite different, and this points to quite different views of the self. Maybe you could expand on that. How are pity and sympathy different on your view?
So sympathy, I think, is not an emotion. It's a psychological mechanism that has to do with the imagination, which allows us to enter into the situations of and situations and minds of others. Whereas pity or pitié is an emotion, namely of pity or compassion. So I think that's one difference between both of these. But more importantly, in what I focus on in that third chapter, is this idea that for Smith, sympathy is part and parcel of our, what I call our ground level sociability. That is to say, our fundamentally social character as human beings, as selves, and it makes possible our access, our epistemic access to each other and to ourselves. So it, sympathy, as it were, stands against a kind of epistemic solipsism, or what I earlier called this Ovidian narcissism. Smith gives this famous, much discussed example towards, you know, well on into the theory of moral sentiments, to the effect that a man can sympathize with a woman in childbirth, not just as it were, in his own persona, but as, so to speak, as her. He must have understood how controversial this would be. Clearly trying to drive home a point. Pity, by contrast, in Rousseau, pity is one of the sort of natural traits of human beings in the state of nature, the savage. Pity, I don't think, involves that kind of transposition or change of perspective. It's not perspective shifting in that way. It puts us in the place of another, but it doesn't open up the other's perspective to us. And this is all, of course, very debatable, whether anything like Smithian sympathy is tenable, or whether, you know, we're doomed to this kind of epistemic solipsism or closedness that Rousseau's theory is suggesting. But I think that's a fundamental disagreement between these two thinkers.
Yes. So pity, if I got this right, pity is, you know, if you feel pity, you feel someone else's feelings. But with sympathy, you actually can occupy their perspective. And by that, it means you can both think and feel what they do, right? There's a cognitive and affective component to it, whereas with the pity, there's just an affective.
Well, pity certainly seemed to be, I mean, maybe there's some, presumably got to be some very minimal cognitive process going on, since you recognize the other to be other and so on and so forth. And then there is a situation that they're in. So there's some kind of cognitive recognition going on, but right. Since the savage has it, and the savage is pre-linguistic and so forth in Rousseau's portrait, his narrative, it does seem to be much more about affect than cognition. Whereas in Smith's case, sympathy, properly speaking, could involve a lot of cognition, and typically must involve, you know, a fair amount of it. So the man who, you know, sympathizes with a woman in childbirth, or the person who sympathizes with somebody else who's lost their only son when the sympathizer doesn't have a son, or let alone an only son, is that the sympathizer is putting him or herself in the position of, not just putting himself in the position of the other and then saying, how would I react, but is understanding what it's like to be the other in their position. And so this is a denial of a kind of epistemic solipsism or self-centeredness on Smith's part. And as I understand what Smith is saying, we are constituted in such a way that we can do this. So that's a rejection of this notion of our, you know, natural selves as asocial, which is the Rousseauan savage, but also of this idea that in social relations, we are deeply and fundamentally cut off from each other and presumably from ourselves too, since for Smith, there isn't a private inner self that's, you know, accessible only to its owner, but there's also the possibility that others can understand you. They can't literally feel your feelings, but they can understand your feelings just as you can in principle with effort and so on, understand theirs. So we're not fundamentally cut off from each other in these ways.
Yeah, so I guess I'm thinking in Rousseau, the moments when he talks about the development of pity, because he says something like, gosh, I don't have the text in front of me, but he says something like, well, you know, pity is the basis of all the social virtues or something along those lines. So at least for Rousseau, pity begins as something purely affective and animalistic, but then it sort of gets then mixed in our civilized condition such that it can form the basis of maybe something more like what Smith is talking about, right? A kind of Smithian sympathy, if you're in the right condition, right? Again, if you're in a republic with fellow citizens, your amour propre is not feverish and the way it is in civilization, but it's guided and, you know, and is sort of hooked up with the general will. And so your pity can align with your amour propre. What do you think about that?
Well, you know, it's interesting enough, unless I'm misremembering, pity is not mentioned in the social contract.
No, you're right. You're right. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, it would have to be you would have to read it in there. I mean, based on some of the suggestions that Rousseau has about the development of pity, you know, pity, he has these comments about pity being the basis of these more social emotions, but then it kind of disappears when you get into society.
Right. And there's the problem. I mean, so how would you read it into the social contract? I guess if I may address a question back to you here.
Yeah. I suppose it would be the sort of affective basis of the civic virtues that would develop, right? When we find a citizen in need and need to protect them or save them. I'm not sure. I haven't worked this out, but it is your, I mean, it is striking that it doesn't end up making an appearance as a way to sort of bind citizens together in the social contract. And that is telling.
Yes. I mean, of course, there are these discussions of pity in the Emile or in Emile.
Right.
Which, as I said, I didn't go into Emile. I just sort of had to draw the line somewhere. So that's one of the places that I drew it. But I suppose to pursue your line of thought further, what one might do is to try to take those discussions and then work them into into Rousseau's account of, the social contract in the book. I'm not sure either exactly how that would happen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So presumably there's a tie between Smithian sympathy understood as this imaginative mechanism for, you know, understanding each other and therefore is crucial to our sociability. There's some tie between that and, as it were, pro-social sentiments like benevolence and so forth. But it is also capable of generating antisocial sentiments. So it's sympathy is not benevolence in Smith.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, that is interesting. It might be a departure from Rousseau because there's a kind of often attributed to Rousseau. Maybe this isn't right, but there's a kind of unity or homogeneity that results in the civil condition. Whereas I take it one of the opportunities on Smith's point of view with the idea of sympathy is you sympathize with others and you retain your individuality. You don't sort of become mind melded into one thing and your individuality effaced, right?
Correct. Yes, I think that's exactly right. At the same time, on the flip side, and this is part of what I think helps make Smith's account so interesting and maybe puzzling, While you do retain your individuality, and he's insistent on the sort of sanctity, to use his term, of, you know, the dignity of the individual, and uses this very flowery religious language to keep underlining that, you know, moral individualism. On the other side, we're social creatures, as sympathetic creatures. We are, you wouldn't have a self except in society. And part of what that means, as I interpret Smith, is that to be a self, to have a self, is already, is to be constituted in such a way that you are in principle accessible to others and vice versa. You wouldn't have a self unless you were aware of yourself, aware of others being aware of you. It's a mirroring kind of relation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we're deeply social in this way, but we're not fundamentally cut off from each other or at odds with each other, although we're not fundamentally benevolent in that sense, sympathetic creatures either.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's turn to the last chapter in your book, which takes up the relationship between religion and politics. Particularly, you focus on Rousseau's famous discussion of civil religion, the penultimate chapter of The Social Contract, which is, I think, the longest chapter. And that final couple pages is really famous, where Rousseau talks about how citizens have to profess to believe in these religious dogmas, not out of a piety, but because it makes us sociable, Rousseau says. They make us good citizens. They shape our particular wills so that we put the general will first. And the dogmas have to do, you know, they're kind of thinly constructed boilerplate religious dogmas, such as the existence of an omnipotent God and the immortality of the soul. Rousseau also adds in things like the sanctity of the social contract and toleration, particularly. Mm-hmm. So I think you do a really nice job. I don't know if we want to add anything to sort of my brief sketch of the Rousseau and the civil religion, but you also develop some of the problems with Rousseau's civil religion from Smith's point of view. So maybe you could say more if you want about the civil religion and what the problems are that you or Smith see.
Right. So this is, as you said, one of the most controversial parts of The Social Contract. The chapter contributed very much to the book being banned in Geneva. Mm-hmm. It cost Rousseau greatly. He never retracted any part of it, so far as I know. And it is, in fact, deeply controversial because he's saying that for the Republic, the society of the social contract, to come into being and to survive, its citizens must sign up for this, you know, this profession, this civil profession of faith. And the dogmas, to use his word, that they have to accept, that the principles or the teachings, do include the existence of God and the singular, the divinity, and a number of other postulates, including, as you say, toleration, such that if one accepts them but then behaves in such a way that one gives off to others that one doesn't believe them, one is put to death. So you're signing up for that too. And anyway, this has greatly distressed people from day one. And sort of from Smith's standpoint, I think, I imagine there would be a number of problems, one of which is, of course, the problem of the death penalty. Another is the problem of toleration. Although it's in favor of toleration, they seem to be, or arguably are, again, this is much contested, pretty strict limits to what is tolerated. Intolerance is not tolerated, Rousseau says very clearly, but there are these dogmas, and you're not supposed to be running around, you know, rejecting them or questioning them. So that doesn't seem that tolerant. There's the problem of the, you know, whether this entire scheme can be realized because of this famous role of the lawgiver in bringing all this, you know, this society into being. There's a problem about the relation of the dogmas to each other. Is the sanctity of the social contract, you know, think of the sanctity of the U.S. Constitution as an analog, dependent on the idea that it comes from God? Does it have sanctity because God legislated it? That's how lawgivers have presented the matter typically over time, Rousseau says. Rousseau doesn't say that that's the logical relation of these dogmas here. That would be quite problematic because the foundation of the social contract in Rousseau's theory is the rational will of the contractor, not God. Mm-hmm. So there's the problem of how to put those together. And then there's the problem of belief, which I spent a fair amount of time talking about, inspired by Bernard Williams's conception of belief. And the basic idea is that you can't choose to believe something, because to believe is to believe that something is true. And you can't choose to believe in something that you know is false. But what if you're a contractor who doesn't believe in these dogmas, but you're free and you are morally self-regulating? You're rational. but actually you don't believe that there's, say, just one God, or you don't believe in the afterlife, what does that mean? You can't be a member of the Society of the Social Contract. So you've got this problem, I argue, about the, about belief that haunts Rousseau's discussion as well.
So maybe to follow up about each of those points, because they're all great, and sort of the last point that you made about belief. I think one of the ways that I've understood what Rousseau is talking about in the civil religions section is not that Rousseau is asking us to actually believe those dogmas, but only profess to believe them. So we have to, that is, that we have to believe them in public. In private, we can do whatever we want. We can be atheists. We can laugh at the religious dogmas. But for the sake of public sociability and the stability of the regime, we need to profess to believe them. So it wouldn't cause a problem from that perspective. I don't know if that gets around William's problem or not. Maybe I misunderstood it. But how does that strike you?
Well, people have argued something like that, and to be fair, these issues are all contested, these interpretive issues as to what Rousseau was saying exactly. So a number of commentators have taken that exact line in order to minimize some of the problems here. I would argue against that. I think that for Rousseau, belief really does matter. We are talking, after all, about a credo which is supposed to buttress one's willingness to sacrifice one's life for the sake of the greater good, for the sake of the good. So I don't know whether a profession alone would do that. I don't think that profession can just mean a pretense here, because I would argue that for Rousseau, self-interest, including your own self-preservation, will win out unless it is successfully checked by a full-fledged, effective, and intellectual subscription to the dogmas that he's setting out. I guess another way to look at it is, if a profession were enough, even without belief, then in joining the Society of the Social Contract, you would be signing up for lifelong hypocrisy.
Right.
On pain of death, if it's discovered that that's what you're actually doing. This is a hypocrisy and fear.
Right.
That doesn't sound like a prescription for freedom. And he's insistent that the Society of the Social Contract would, leave us as free as we were before. And as I think it was Rawls who said, not just as free, but actually we are freer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that would come at a very high price, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. I suppose there's also a way in which it's sort of contextualized according to his time. You know, most individuals would be religious believers, I assume, in this time. And so he, you know, it wouldn't be that onerous for, you know, so speaking to Christians broadly, right? It wouldn't be that onerous for Christians to believe these dogmas. These are sort of thin articulations about, abstractions of what they believe. And indeed, you know, a way to sort of overcome conflicts between Catholics and Protestants, because they say, hey, look, Catholics, Protestants, you both believe these basic truths, that you can be bound together and not have to fight over the details. You could be bound together in these more core dogmas. So at least for them, it wouldn't be an infringement on freedom. Now, I suppose more, for a sort of contemporary prescription, this would be much more problematic in the sense that it could be, freedom reducing for, look at the last Pew Forum on religious belief, the number of people who believe in no religion has increased, massively over the past 10 years, right? This would be a problem for them.
Well, yes, maybe a number of his readers at the time would have found the dogmas pretty uncontroversial, except maybe the one about toleration.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But on the other hand, he doesn't talk about Christ. There's no bureaucratic mechanism. There's no church here for enforcing these that he mentions. They're just these dogmas that you're supposed to sign up for. So it's very stripped down, but they're also very substantive. I mean, they do, after all, involve, the commitment to the existence of God, a just God, and so forth. So that's a lot. And contractors in the state of nature, not just in, you know, his, you know, 18th century Geneva or something. This is a state of nature doctrine, which is presumably addressed to people everywhere at all time. So this is supposed to be the way it is. And contractors in the state of nature are supposed to, you know, this is what you would sign up for. So I think that does create some problems for this view that really is not all that controversial for the period that he was, you know, writing in. I don't know if you consider that to be a successful answer to your question or not.
No, well, I mean, it might be working at two different levels. I mean, one is the sort of ideal theory contractualist level, and the other is, I guess, more of the sort of empirical level that, you know, in Rousseau's time. But to sort of, I guess, take up on the point about the, you know, would contractors and, you know, Rousseau's social contract sign up for a civil religion, right? It doesn't seem like it makes much sense. Why would you, if you're, you know, behind Rawls's veil of ignorance, you know, why would you sign up for a civil religion? Because you might be someone who's an agnostic or atheist, and then you're consigning yourself to a life of unfreedom and fear, you know, et cetera, what you said. You know, but at the same time, you might think, well, you know, if you're working from Rousseau's views of human nature, the general will is difficult to achieve for most human beings, and it looks like you might need something like religion, on his view, in order to educate particular wills to the general will. At least that's the way his argument would go. So individuals behind the veil of ignorance might take that into consideration, right? You know, okay, well, so I might have to, you know, conceal my views in public for my life, but at least that will allow us to have social harmony or something like that. You know, so it seems like there might be a trade-off between stability and freedom, which I'm not sure. I mean, I don't know how that strikes you, but
I think that's very opposite, because part of what this part of chapter of Rousseau's book forces us to confront is precisely the question of the possible trade-off between stability and freedom, social cohesion on the one hand, and you know, liberty of the individual on the other. And this is, as we know, very much of a ongoing problem. It just is a deep problem. And you know, behind the veil of ignorance, or even not behind the veil of ignorance, a potential contractor might say, I can see the case for something like this credo, because otherwise this community is not going to survive. There has to be a set of shared moral principles. They've got to be backed up with some religious doctrine. People must believe in them. I don't believe in them, but I'll subject myself to a psychological procedure that makes me believe in them.
Right.
Or I'll take a special pill that makes me believe. I'll do something like that, because I won't just fake it. I won't just profess. But I understand that I, too, have to believe in them. Furthermore, I don't want to be killed if I find out that I don't believe in them. So I'll do something like that. But then, of course, you know, there's an enigma inside of an enigma. Then does that mean that to belong to a stable and free republic, and which is composed of free individuals, one has to be deluded about what one's true views would be were one able to pursue them?
Right.
And that's another way of stating the possibly tragic situation here.
Yeah, the one of the final points you made, which is quite an interesting one and a puzzle on Rousseau's theory, is this: the sort of way there's, it seems like, a tension between the social contract on the one hand, the way in which the individuals, parties to the social contract, construct the laws, and then on the other hand, the sort of authority or source of the law, say the source of the laws rather than the authority, that it seems like it should be divinely inspired. And this is underscored also in the lawgiver section, the lawgiver chapter in book two, where Rousseau talks about how, you know, the lawgiver needs to give laws to the people, and the lawgiver has recourse to, you know, religious faith or, you know, religious inspiration. And he cites Machiavelli, and Machiavelli is talking about Numa in Rome, and he uses all this sort of nonsense Machiavelli talks about to get to delude people. Anyway, there seems like this kind of tension. I think what you bring out quite well between the two, and it seems like what one has to say at the end of the day is that the people serve as a kind of, could be a veto or an approval, an affirmation of the received content or source of the law from the lawgiver. And that doesn't seem like freedom, right? At the end of the day, or the kind of full-fledged freedom that Rousseau is talking about. I don't know if that made sense or if you're following me on that.
Right. Yes, I think I follow you. Right. So this is also debated. I mean, there are some interpreters who say, well, if you feel that you're free, and if it feels as though you're, legislating, for yourself and others, and if it feels as though you've adopted these, dogmas of the civil religion without coercion, then you are free. But that doesn't seem very satisfactory, because as we know from other parts of Rousseau, there's such a thing as, being ignorant of your ignorance. So what's to distinguish that condition of things from that of a happy slave? Mm-hmm. So there have to be pretty significant rationality requirements here, such that you are aware that you are, choosing something because it's true. So the pill option or something like that for subscribing to these dogmas seems to undermine the project as a whole. But so does the idea that you should subscribe to the social contract because it comes from God. Because after all, it doesn't come from God, actually. It comes from you, mm-hmm. according to Rousseau. Mm-hmm. That's what makes it legitimate.
Yeah, let's shift over to Smith. Smith shares a lot of Rousseau's concerns about the need for religion, but offers somewhat of a different prescription. It's not a sort of top-down prescribing certain dogmas to the people, but it's more of a bottom-up, a marketplace of religions in which individuals can choose, and the sovereign's remains neutral among different religious beliefs. Much more sort of standard fare for a liberal to believe. How does this, in what ways does this improve on Rousseau? What ways does it suffer from that criticism and that the dialectic that you bring forward from Rousseau?
Yeah, so those are among the million-dollar questions that arise in the course of this. It would seem to improve on it in that it's less coercive. There's no death penalty for not believing in a set of religious postulates. It's very pluralistic, religiously speaking. It doesn't actually exclude atheism, which presumably Rousseau's scheme does, or the profession of atheism anyways.
And Locke did. Locke did too.
And Locke did too. So Smith is very, very tolerant, pro-tolerance that way. The state is meant to be impartial, as he puts it, between different sects and just to keep the peace between them. So that all sounds very attractive, ditto then the marketplace of religions in which, religious leaders compete for disciples. Presumably that helps to keep them responsive to their customers and to deliver the goods, whatever the goods are exactly. That all seems good. But on the other hand, I think Rousseau could say, look, your proposed solution of the marketplace of religions is not going to work because it's assuming what is supposed to yield. What is supposed to yield, according to Smith, is moderation, a toleration, a pure and rational religion, as he calls it, basically religion of civic peace and mutual respect. But it won't function unless you already have that in place, Rousseau might say. So it's assuming what it's supposed to prove. So it's not going to work. I mean, maybe it'll work for a minute somewhere in Pennsylvania or something, as Smith says, but it can't be the solution because before people have acquired the relevant morality, this pure and rational religion, they will be self-interested. And there actually is a lot of talk in Smith about ways in which sympathy can operate in a way that accentuates the propensity for violence. So he gives these descriptions that I quote of, cabals forming, people praising, the violent and triumphal conquests of their leaders. You know, people become very bonded with each other and very against others. This is not news to Smith that there's these conflicts between religions, but then, you know, I think Rousseau can quite legitimately say, why will a marketplace of religions do anything more than give people a prudential reason for not attacking each other at that moment? But that can't be the formula of a stable and free republic. And I think that's a real problem for Smith. And it's a problem that we're still struggling with. This, again, how to have social unity, stability, freedom, and rationality, how to have all of that together. It's accentuated, just to take this a step further, by Smith's own comments about our natural love to domineer others. These are very troubling remarks of his, in which he essentially says that if people can get away with it, they'll choose to dominate others rather than have to stoop to persuade them to do their will. Well, you know, if that's true, then Rousseau might say, how is your marketplace of religions going to work? So I don't solve this dialectic, but it seems to me this is, you know, part of the crucial back and forth between them about this issue.
That's great. I wanted to finish off with a final question that about the dialogue that you do set up, that it's a choice between two languages about politics and two different utopias, and that evaluating their dialogue deepens our understanding of at least some of these ongoing conflicts. I think maybe you could say a little bit about how understanding the dialogue between these two can help illuminate anything about our contemporary situation, anything perhaps about modern commercial society, which Rousseau and Smith have very different views about, or any other aspect you think of modern commercial society that this dialogue between the two helps illuminate.
Right. So the first part of your quotation about a choice between two languages about politics and so forth, of course, comes from Michael Ignatieff, whom I'm quoting there. And my sense is that we are today very much talking past each other on a number of issues. Not only talking past each other, I mean, there's a huge amount of discussion at this very moment, of course, about, you know, sort of the tribalism of American politics and how there are these rival groups and they sort of view each other as moral monsters and they can't seem to communicate, even though we're all fellow citizens and we're all in a way talking about the same things. There seem to be these very, very different positions. And not only that, but sadly, people don't seem to understand that there could be valid objections against their own view put by the other side or by somebody, and that they're not necessarily 100% right. So this is kind of very unfortunate self-insulating, feature of this, talking past one another. And I wanted to both model and explore a dialectic between Smith and Rousseau, because a number of the issues that they're talking about are still the issues that are on the table today. And if nothing else, at least understanding that there is valid controversy about them, that there are pros and cons, might help us to moderate and to deepen our own views. To take an example, there is precisely the civil religion issue that we've just been discussing, the role of religion in public life, how necessary it is, how to reconcile it with freedom of choice of religion. There is, I think, the crucial issue of Ovidian narcissism, as I call it, or epistemic, or the epistemic limitations when it comes to understanding each other. I mean, are we hemmed in by our own identities such that we can't really understand one another? Are we really closed off? If you have a certain kind of experience as a such and such person and I'm different from you, does that mean that I have to defer to your own account of yourself? I can't get into your shoes and understand your perspective from your standpoint. Is that true or false? It's very important issue, as I think we now see today. What is the right standpoint to turn to another issue for understanding our situation? I mean, are we like happy slaves, like the prisoners in Plato's cave? And do we need a sort of a systematic debunker like Rousseau, who's on the outside and who's somehow, you know, become enlightened to make us woke, as they say now, so that we see how these injustices of inequality or whatever permeate everything? Is that the right standpoint to take? Or is something more like Smith's standpoint, which is embedded but also separate from that of common life, which is much more gradualist, which is less stark in its vision, which allows for degrees of apprehension? Is something like that more acceptable? That, I think, is also a kind of a contest between two different sorts of standpoints on social reality. What about freedom and the connection between freedom and authenticity? Freedom in being inside or outside of yourself, that I talk about in the fourth chapter of the book. Which of those is the right standpoint? So I think the issues that are at stake between these two thinkers remain with us. And although I don't pretend to have, you know, solved them, and I don't declare one thinker or the other to be, you know, correct, understanding them is, I believe, well worth our time and effort.
Well, this conversation and reading your book has been well worth my efforts. So I very much appreciated you agreeing to do this, and I had a lovely time, Charles. So thank you for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. And thanks to you for listening.